Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Arvin Hickman, and welcome to the PR Weekly. In this episode, we're going to discuss England in the Euros and racism in sport, BBC Independence and Robbie Gibb, as well as what PR agencies are planning as Freedom Day approaches. Today, we are joined by Thread and Fable founder and former West Bromwich Albion press officer Rebecca Roberts, sports PR agency Calicus founder and former BBC broadcast journalist David Alexander, and Borkowski PR founder Mark Borkowski. Welcome to you all.
Hi.
Hi there.
Let's kick off with the Euros and a hangover of racism directed at Rashford, Saka and Sancho, marring what has otherwise been an outstanding tournament and English campaign. Now, there's a lot to unpack here and we'll be discussing the racism issue in a moment. But to begin with, the English team led by Gareth Southgate, I feel has really enhanced the Three Lions brand and brought 4 weeks of joy and one night of heartbreak to the nation. Mark, surely this has been a really positive month for English football, aside from some of the ugly scenes at Wembley and the racism issue.
It was a very positive month. I use the past tense because obviously we are now overshadowed by a set of events, both on and off the field, which perhaps has sort of killed off what was remarkable positivity after, you know, very sad 18 months of us all being gripped by COVID. I'm a boomer. I'm long enough to remember sort of following England for many, many years as a football fan. And of course, I'm embedded with the sort of gene that says that England will always fail. And sometimes I think of the bad karma created by the England football fans as being part of the reason. I remember I was on the tube heading home to watch the quarterfinal game against Germany, and I was greeted by a bevy of sort of Neanderthals all clutching blow-up Spitfires on the tube line, sort of humming the Dambusters theme. And mm-hmm. I thought, nothing changes. And it takes us right back to some of those ugly scenes we saw with violence, particularly with away supporters going off, not really to see the football, to have a damn good scrap. But I mean, we're seeing a greater professionalism now in the way, and I was very, very impressed with, you know, that handle Gareth Southgate had, not just on the team, but also on the media, which I thought was a first. I think it was the first time we'd gone into a championship without facing some major PR scandal that has been, you know, heralded by some action by a footballer on his way to the tournament. It was, it was a highly professional way of dealing with the media, keeping the team together, stripping all these club enmities. And it was great hope because expectations, I don't think, were particularly high, although England did get through, obviously, to the semi-final in the World Cup. But there felt that there was a new beginning, new hope. And I'm afraid we've crashed down the snake after climbing a ladder right to ground zero again.
I mean, it's a really good point that you raised there about the professionalism and the way that Southgate, and I also believe the players, handled the media. It definitely has a very different flavour and feel to it from previous English campaigns. David, what's really depressing about this ugly episode is that, you know, it's all too predictable. Can you give us a bit of context about racism in football in the past and where this sort of latest incident places?
Going back, Mark was talking about the history of English football fandom. And I think, you know, growing up as a young kid in the 70s and 80s, you know, I encountered quite a lot of racism, having a father from the Caribbean. And as we got into the 90s and the 2000s, things became more tolerant and more multicultural and more accepting. And it felt like we were in a really positive place societally. And I think that peaked around 2012, around the Olympic Games, because you had the diversity. You know, it was no surprise that Danny Boyle would try and promote the NHS, given the potential threats that it might have faced. And everything sort of came crashing down after that, from a society perspective, in terms of the lead up and then the hangover from Brexit and the stoking of division that we've seen over the last few years, and then has been highlighted over the last few weeks from the politicians that lead this country. And unfortunately, you know, politicians have been saying over and over again, you know, footballers should stick to football. They shouldn't get involved in politics, when actually these footballers don't have anything to lose. They have an opportunity to use their platform in an elegant and articulate way, and they're being authentic. They're not trying to do it to gain fans, to gain clicks. They're doing it, you know, Marcus Rashford, for instance, you know, he's had a lot of criticism, and yet he's forced the government into two U-turns because he's doing something for the greater good. And it's very hard even for politicians to turn around and criticise him when what he's basically saying is, I just don't want kids to go hungry.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting point that you raise about the players being authentic and you know, they're raising issues using their platforms and social media, issues that are really important to them. Rebecca, you wrote an excellent piece on PR Week about politicians' role in all of this. You cited Tyrone Ming's post about Priti Patel and taking the knee. You also mentioned that it was a missed opportunity for Downing Street after the final. Can you elaborate on what you mean by this?
Yeah, so obviously we had much speculated talk of a bank holiday that may happen if we should win. And there's also discussion about some sort of reception that would be held at number 10. And obviously this is always a PR moment. We've seen England cricketers, and we've seen, obviously, 2012, we had the bus tour through London. And obviously the FA have come out and said, well, we already decided that if we lost, that wouldn't be appropriate, and we kind of declined it. But there is a lot of speculation, like, who would decline that? Would the footballers, or would number 10 now feel that this is slightly uncomfortable? It's interesting, the Tyrone Mings tweet, because, you know, it was labelled last night on Newsnight as, you know, accusation of Priti Patel sort of stoking the fire. But it was really setting out quite clearly, in fact, that you can't call an act of anti-racism one thing when you've actually not supported them from the start, and sort of said to fans, well, actually, if you boo it, we're not going to condemn you for it. So he sort of set out very clearly his view. And I think they've almost held up a mirror to what anti-racism looks like to the government. And I think that becomes an uncomfortable truth for them. And I would wager a bet that the players would actually have wanted to use the opportunity to talk about, you know, stuff like the online bill, what more can be done. There's some very real issues that could have been demonstrated. A spokesman came out on Monday, I think it was, to say that Johnson would be okay with them taking a knee at number 10, as if that's some sort of gracious kind of moment. And obviously today, just in the Commons a little earlier, he said that, you know, any racists online that are giving players online abuse will not get to watch the football, no ifs or buts. They won't get to watch live sport. But how they actually do that in practice, and when this online safety bill will come into action, is anyone's guess right now.
It is, isn't it, Mark? And it's really interesting how politicians, some politicians, not all of course, have been sort of fanning the flames about taking the knee, that sort of stuff, and really setting it up. And now they're coming out and trying to promote an anti-racist message. Quite confusing. Well, what do you think can be done about this? I mean, I guess we've discussed this many times before in terms of what social media companies can do. But what more do you think can be done to help tackle hate online and to stop these players being racially abused?
Look, there's one way. I mean, when we look at the huge technology leaps that we make, and the huge positivity that supposedly was going to come with social media, we're beginning to see it's just a tool for a large majority of people to be abusive. Nothing came home. Football didn't come home. What came home was sort of racist abuse. That's what we saw on Monday morning. And I think that we're going to have to get tough on the likes of the social media channels, the likes of sort of Facebook, Instagram, and of course, Twitter. And if there's a commercial paradigm that these social channels have to protect, they're on top of deleting rogue copy very quickly. No sooner has someone streamed some rogue pirate football stream, it's down in minutes. And let's not sit on the fence about this. They should and they could be doing more. The combined efforts of TV channels like ITV and Sky getting together, you know, the weekend of avoiding it, until there is some tough regulation, until we can actually go and search out these people who anonymously hide behind their troll-like persona, nothing will change, because we've made huge strides in trying to give, you know, this a positive voice. And I'm absolutely sickened that we're still debating it in such an evil way. We're going so far back. And until we get some, you know, real teeth into the neck of these internet companies, ever going to be the same. There was 1 million people supposedly signing, according to the Sun at 10 o'clock in the morning, 1 million people signing petitions. That's a tiny number compared to how many people watch the game. 1 million people is not enough to show the absolute anger of what we're seeing, because it's the same old, same old.
I want to get your views as well, David and Rebecca. David, let's start off with you. What more do you think needs to be done to tackle this issue?
There's been some debate about whether or not there should be some sort of two-stage identification process for social media channels. But many people who have worked within those social media platforms have said that, you know, doing that then weakens the position of those in perhaps more tyrannical and less tolerant countries who may actually be trying to use their voice in a way where they don't, being identified could be a risk to their lives. But I agree with Mark, you know, there does need to be more done. You know, I see numerous people who make very legitimate observations on Twitter, for instance, and then they disappear, and then they say, "Oh, I've just been banned for 2 weeks." And yet, people who work for estate agents and such like, who claim that their phones have been hacked or lost straight after the game when they've been sharing obscene, racist abuse, don't seem to suffer the same fate. I think it's very difficult to see how, and what with the power and influence that these social media channels have. You know, they've taken over to some degree from the big multimedia conglomerates run by the Murdochs of this world that used to have the influence to shape opinion and votes and governments.
Rebecca, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with both Mark and David. Like, on the one hand, you would sort of point to government to say you can't have this mixed message where we're going to say we're not going to condemn you for booing. However, we will get really cross and sort of call you out if you give us a paper trail and make number 10 look bad. So the consistency is needed there in terms of anti-racism.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When it comes to social media, it's an interesting one. I've spoken to a number of journalists at quite a lot of female sports journalists, actually, who have absolutely abhorrent threats all the time, particularly when they're commenting on men's sport. And, you know, I've spoke to Florence Lloyd Hughes, who's had like death threats on her sort of football punditry. And she's like, this is ridiculous. You know, we've taken it to the police and they're sort of not taking it massively seriously. And I think the reporting side is really an issue here because, as David's just said, you know, I've seen quite a lot of people who've actually been reporting issues. However, Instagram, for example, were sort of rejecting that something was racist and then actually shadow blocking several accounts as well of people who were reporting the issue. And like Mark alluded to, you know, if you shared a clip of a bit of broadcast coverage that you weren't meant to, or a piece of news that you don't have rights to, they're very quick to act on that. So it's not like the technology isn't there. And I think that's where this online safety bill, real pressure has to come with real consequences for these companies to actually demonstrate they are able to do something. Or I just think we're going to have this rumbling on for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, unfortunately so. It's quite depressing, isn't it? Well, I just hope that, you know, in years to come, it's England's football that we remember and how they brought the nation together, albeit fleetingly. But anyway, I want to move on to our next topic, which is the other major media story of the week. The Financial Times recently reported that Robbie Gibb, who spent most of his career at the BBC before becoming a communications director for Theresa May, attempted to stop former HuffPost UK editor and deputy Newsnight editor Jess Brammer from being appointed to a key editorial role. Mark, what is your take on this and what does it mean for the BBC's independence?
I have a huge amount of sympathy for poor Tim Davey, who's inherited a frothing, steaming, poison chalice. It's always been about ownership. And I've worked with the BBC many, many years ago as a young communicator. And there was some pretty forthright head of comms at the BBC who really defended the impartiality of the BBC with some venom. That was weakened as we went down through the years, particularly through John Burt's time, when, you know, there wasn't the same aggressive tactics to watch it. And, you know, to a certain extent, I think the BBC always considers the Daily Mail factor. What does the Daily Mail think about that? There's no strength of position. The BBC are at its weakest now. And the impartiality has always been the great ground that people describe, you know. The BBC is struggling to make sense of itself in an age of Netflix and Apple and a huge amount of competition for audiences. And of course, the up-and-coming license fee debate will roll on. We see a lot of influence from politicians in terms of perhaps defunding the BBC, perhaps trying to run it. So there's huge amount of consternation. I don't know how far away from W1A it is, but at times one thinks it isn't that far away from it being a satirical point of reference. But it's come up with, you know, what is the BBC going to be and stand for? Because, you know, the audience looks at the way that it's trying to address and diversity, address what its shape and form should be in the 22nd century, let alone the 21st century. And it struggles. As a state broadcaster, it is struggling. There is a soft underbelly. It's a perception that they do indulge in cronyism. And there is a minor subplot there. They're using tactics to turn the BBC into a propaganda service. So, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And I think with all this constitutional issues surrounding the BBC, it's very difficult to modernise and strike a brand that actually means something.
It's in a really difficult position, isn't it, Rebecca? And you know, I know with some of the BBC's reporting in particular, there are always accusations that it isn't impartial from both the left and the right. What do you think this latest scandal does for the BBC?
I think we saw over Brexit real challenge over how much airtime they were showing to the likes of Farage, for example. And that really stimulated myself, you know, to question, like, well, what news outlet would I want to watch? But this whole Robbie Gibbs scenario isn't new. I mean, just 2 months ago, there was a decision vetoed by ministers not to renew boardroom positions of Usma Hassan and Fru Hazlett at Channel 4 against the advice of Channel 4 board and Ofcom. And both were replaced with Conservative allies leading media roles. So what we're seeing is, yes, the BBC are kind of shown as having problems, but I kind of think that fuels the ideal kind of privatisation that perhaps the Conservative Party would want to go for and sort of breaking down of the BBC in some way, because they're doing it elsewhere.
What's your take on this, David?
Well, I have to hold my hands up. I was a broadcast journalist for the BBC for about 3 years and very proud to have been there. The brilliance of some of the editors on the programmes on Radio 5 that I worked with was something to behold. And there was a real fight, obviously, you know, to try and ensure impartiality. And of course, as others have said, you know, there's always that risk that you can be damned if you do, damned if you don't, as far as how you interpret a story. But I've also lived abroad. Arvind, you've lived abroad. You know, the BBC has been revered as one of the major broadcast news organisations around the world. But I think, you know, those journalists that I still know that work at the BBC have certainly felt that they have been stifled somewhat by the fear of more regulation, the inevitable cuts that have gone across the broadcasting and wider journalism world. It's always going to be a challenge to make sure that you have that balance between impartiality and also with a government like that we have at the moment, where you have to ensure that you're not creating too much outrage, which is going to create the concerns, as you've mentioned, to do with things like the license fee. I think it's ironic that Jacob Rees-Mogg yesterday, I think it was complaining about the fact that there's never anyone from Tory central office that gets considered for some of the major news roles or managerial roles at the BBC. Mark mentioned Tim Davey, who was chairman of the Hammersmith and Fulham Conservative Party and a Tory councillor candidate in the past. The narrative is divisive again. I think the BBC has got to find its role and its voice, and whether or not it's going to be able to do that remains to be seen.
It's a really interesting point, isn't it? And I find it quite amusing coming from Australia, where we have the ABC and the exact same tactics, the exact same attacks from the right side of politics target them as well. Right, and finally, so-called Freedom Day is fast approaching, when all COVID restrictions in the UK, or at least in England, will be abolished. I'd like to hear from each of you how you are preparing your agencies for Freedom Day, what clients are saying, and you know, how you're preparing your teams to return to the office and all that sort of stuff. Rebecca, let's start off with you and your plans for Thread and Fable.
So I work with a lot of other independents, so on collaborative projects, so I won't necessarily need an office space suddenly. What I am hearing from clients is they are doing a much more slow return to normal. There is a lot of challenge, I guess, from, you know, they've put all these policies in place, HR departments to protect people, rotation of office teams, and a lot of them are now speaking to staff about how they can't just suddenly drop things, in their view. So I think that whilst the restrictions may come off, I don't, for some people I'm speaking to, aren't suddenly dropping everything.
It's a good point, isn't it, David, about how the government will have its guidance, but actually it'll be up to individual businesses, won't it, to manage the safety of their own staff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, similarly to Rebecca, you know, my team is spread around the country, and a lot of our clients are international. So actually a lot of what we do won't change. I think, you know, some of the weekly face-to-face meetings will return slowly but surely, but some of the huge companies that we work with, they're going to be very slow going back to the office. In fact, some of them have said they're not really going to get to anything like full speed as far as office attendance is concerned until the start of 2022. I think what will be good from an agency perspective will be just that opportunity to meet people face to face again, you know, just the general networking and discussions and industry conferences and such like that just haven't been taking place. I'm looking forward to things getting a little bit back to normal. I have to say I've been into London a couple of times over the last 6 months or so, and it's a very different place to how it was 18 months ago or so.
Absolutely. Mark, what's happening at Borkowski? How are you planning for Freedom Day and gradually returning to normal with your team?
We spent quite a bit of money making our offices safe for people to work in. There was a number of people, younger people in my organisation, who found it incredibly difficult to work at home simply because of their the way they lived in small flats. I employed two or three people in the COVID, of which I didn't really meet them until about this time last year, which was very odd. Our office has been open for business, and people have been coming back for some time now. A lot of people do want to be back in the office. There are certain people who prefer to working from home, and I've left it to individuals to make that choice. I'm not pushing anybody to come back into office environment. But I was in last week, I'm in about 2 days a week now, and I was stunned to see that we had, you know, quite a lot of people back in the office because they wanted to be back in the office. As far as clients, I think some people are very happy with Zoom connections and virtual connections. Other people are not. People want face-to-face meetings. They've been very few and far between for obvious reasons. But in terms of the collaborative process that we go through as a working environment, some of the stuff we've been doing has been extraordinary, and because we've been back together again. I think that we're not really going to see the shape of this, in my estimation. I don't really buy totally into this this awfully termed Freedom Day. I think that we're really not going to see the back end of this until we get through another what is deemed as a flu season or COVID season. Maybe spring, summer next year, we'll know the real shape of things.
Indeed. It sounds like we are definitely not out of the woods and there is still some uncertainty ahead. But hopefully with things opening up, it'll be a little bit more positive and town centres like London can get back to being the vibrant, wonderful cities they are. That is all we have time for. Thank you very much to Rebecca, David and Mark for joining us, and to our producer, Lindsay Riley from Rethink Audio, for putting this episode together. If you want to read up more about what we've discussed today and the latest industry news and views, please visit our new look website, prweek.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Arvin Hickman. Until next time, goodbye.